Okay. Our final exhortation is to be brought to us by our brother Don Lockard. He has titled his words, "The Devil Made Me Do It," and has requested that we read Romans chapter 7, verses 7 through 25. So Romans 7, beginning at verse 7, where Paul writes, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I had not known sin but by the law, for I had not known lust except the law said, Thou shalt not covet. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence, for without the law, sin was dead. For I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment, which was ordained to life, I found to be unto death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. Wherefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. Was then that which is good made death unto me? God forbid. But sin, that it might appear sin, working death in me by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceeding sinful. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that do I not, but what I hate, that do I. If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now then it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good I find not. For the good that I would I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. Now if I do that I would not, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. I find in a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin." Now let us turn our attention over to our brother Don Lockard.
Being the last speaker at a gathering is a tough position. Everybody has been fed and been sitting now for 2 days. You've just been fed again and it's getting warm. But I'm not going to let you go to sleep on me today, because I'm going to ask you some questions and I need you to try and answer me. First question. Has anybody here ever been to court? Raise your hand. Couple of them, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. Well, I've been to court several times, about 5 times, I guess. Each time it's been as a result of me being subpoenaed as a witness, usually to a traffic accident. They live up in an area where the weather's not all that great most of the time, and people slide into the ditch, and it seems like when you stop to help somebody out, you get hauled to court as a witness. But what's interesting about it is that every time that I've been there, it's just generally an unpleasant experience. It's just something you realize very quickly, you shouldn't be there. This is not where we belong. This is another side of life that we don't, by the grace of God, see very often. We're pretty well insulated from that, thankfully. One of the things, though, that I have noted each time that I've been into a courtroom is that, you know, the judge has a tough job. It's not an easy job. I sure wouldn't want it by any means, even in a worldly position. That's not something that I'd want to be. They have to wade through all that evidence. They've got to digest the testimony. They've got to try and determine truth from lies. They've got to evaluate opinions. They've got to evaluate options and consider outcomes. You know, this idea of evaluating is something that we do all of our lives. Evaluating and being evaluated. It's a two-way street. And it starts in kindergarten. You know, your parents drop you off that first day in kindergarten, and you got to go out and evaluate, who you're going to play in a sandbox with. Of course, it gets more complicated. You go through grade school, and you have to evaluate who you're going to eat lunch with, who you're going to play on the playground with, what kids you like, what kids you don't like. Through high school, becomes more of a two-way street now, evaluating and being evaluated. You're being graded, certainly, ranked, scored, critiqued as you go along. You apply for a driver's license. Well, that's all one way. You are being evaluated. You apply to go into a college, to enter into a college. And, again, it's a two-way evaluation. You're looking at, is that the school that I want to go to? Do they have the courses that I want? Is this the campus where I want to be? Is this the town where I want to be? Do they have an ecclesia? And the list goes on and on. Of course, they're evaluating you as well. And it's not just grade point average they're looking at. What kind of a person are you? What are your interests? What's the likelihood that you're going to succeed and get through this 3, 4, 5-year course of study? What's going to be done? Of course, all through college, perhaps more of a one-way evaluation. You're being ranked, scored, tested daily, weekly, monthly. Search for a job, it's almost the same set of questions as applying to a college. Is this the company I want to work for? Is this the career that I want to be involved in? Is this the area, the town that I want to be in? Do they have an ecclesia? And, of course, it's two-way. They're evaluating you. Do they want you to represent their company? All during your working career, of course, you're being evaluated. They call those performance reviews. So this whole idea of evaluating, it's something that we should all be really good at. We've been doing it for years. So this afternoon, we want to draw on all that experience, and I want to have you, every one of you sitting out here, evaluate the question that our topic poses. The devil made me do it. Is that a fact, a provable statement, or is it fiction? Well, it's a little bit of an unusual Christadelphian topic. You know, our position would be, that's just not possible. The devil made me do it, you know. And it can't happen. It's not real. It's fiction. It's whatever. As a Christadelphian topic, why would we even talk about that? In fact, we don't hear it very often as a Christadelphian topic. But why would we talk about it? Well, I'll tell you why we should talk about it. I live near Hamilton, Ontario. I go to the Hamilton Ecclesia, now named Mountain Grove, since we moved several years ago to a new building. I attend that. It's one of only a couple of unadmitted ecclesias in southern Ontario. A lot of you, most of you, have been up there. And although it's only there's only a couple of unamended ecclesias in southern Ontario, it's the same couple of unamended ecclesias that exist throughout the entire country. All of the country of Canada, 2.5 times land mass of the U.S. What I'm getting at is a pretty small and restricted circle of association that I have going to the Hamilton Ecclesia. And yet, out of our little ecclesia, little, constrained, out of that restricted circle of people, brothers and sisters, that we know and associate with and meet with, out of that restricted circle, in the last several years, there are 3 young brothers that have left us, that have left Christadelphia. They have joined themselves to other churches. It's sad, it's hard to believe, it's heartbreaking. But these 3 brothers, who used to call themselves Christadelphians and have disassociated themselves from our belief, our doctrine, our teaching, our structure, our community, and have joined themselves to these other churches, 3 different churches, by the way, 3 brothers having left now, joined 3 other churches, 3 different churches, and all 3 of those churches believe in, teach, espouse, have as doctrine a personal, living, tangible devil. Maybe not necessarily the guy with the little pink and the tail, but they all believe in and teach and espouse the devil. Christadelphians that have left and gone that direction. My point is that if in my little circle of association in the frozen north, in a small community, relatively speaking, if there's 3 out of my little meeting, how many are there here in the U.S.? Because if there's 3 up there, I'll guarantee you there's more that are questioning the concept. So we want to borrow some of these points of order from this hallmark system we've got of a courtroom and this evaluation system here in North America. This is our courtroom here today. And you are the jury. I want you to be the jury. I want you to listen to the evidence. And I want you to evaluate, there's that good word again, I want you to evaluate if there is even so much as a reasonable doubt involved in using this, well, what we have, the devil made me do it, using this as a statement of defense, because that's what it is. It's an attempt to defend a prior action or a train of thought. And you know, in a real courtroom setting, a jury must, by law, toss out the charge if there is a reasonable doubt concerning guilt. This statement of defense, the devil made me do it, is a position stand that leads to so many logical inconsistencies that we can do much better than just show reasonable doubt concerning where we should put our faith in the eternal. You're the jury this afternoon. So our statement of defense, the devil made me do it. Is it fact or is it fiction? Is it true or is it false? Is it reasonable or unreasonable? Is it solid or is it doubtful? I want to look at it from 4 perspectives in this afternoon. Firstly, to accept that statement, the devil made me do it, to accept that as a statement of defense, it presupposes the existence of a devil. It requires that you already pre-believe in the existence of a devil. It's almost a rhetorical statement. One without the other, the circle's not closed. Second viewpoint that we want to look at it is this concept of free will versus a controlled mind. I don't want to wade too far into that mind field, but for this statement to be true, the devil made me do it. For that to be true, the person has to be controlled. The devil made me do it. The person has to be controlled. Consider the mad scientist who's come up with a robot. He's designed a robot. Maybe it's a moving computer, but he's still got a robot of some kind. He can either program the thing to obey his commands, or he can program it that it doesn't have to obey his commands. A random crash bot, if you will. But it's one or the other. We'll look into that more as we go along. The third vantage point that we want to look at to try to look at this as a statement of defense is, kind of a blunt statement, if it's true, what'd the devil get out of it? If there is a devil, what'd the devil get out of it? What's the pay? What's the reward? What did he get out of it? Why did he do it? Finally, the fourth perspective that we'll learn to look at this is, if this statement is true, the devil made me do it, as a defense, then if this statement is used as a defense, it actually removes the person from any blame or wrongdoing, and it transfers responsibility to the devil, if one exists. Therefore, this whole statement used as a defense, it becomes academic. It becomes irrelevant when it's applied to a person, because it takes the person out of the equation. These four and supportable concepts will be developed this afternoon to show that there is much more than just a reasonable doubt that the devil could make anyone do anything. And brothers and sisters and young people, listen to me. For a concept this important, we're talking about an eternity in the kingdom of God through grace, or not if we turn our back on God. Only a fool would stake their salvation on a basis, on a foundation about which they had a reasonable doubt. You be the evaluator this afternoon. We could put up dozens of references, and we could debate each criticism. We could pull out Strong's and look up each word and look at the syntax of it. That's not what I want to do. I want us to examine the logical consequences of this line of reasoning and consider the resulting inconsistencies that come out of that. So from the first perspective, to use this statement as a defense requires that we accept the concept of a devil, requires that we accept as a precondition the existence of a devil. So does a personal, tangible, detectable, that's key to it, detectable living devil actually exist? That's a question that people have been asking for a long time. There's a television show by the name of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Anybody seen that? Hello, a lot of hands this time. Okay. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Seems like everybody does, but the contestant goes on to that show, sits down, and the host or hostess starts asking a series of inane questions. And they start out pretty simple. 2 + 2 is what? And they're all proud of themselves to get the answer. Of course, as they go on, the questions get more difficult. They become more obtuse and irrelevant to anything. And at some point, they have to seek outside help. They've got to, I guess you can call a friend or you can poll the audience or whatever. Okay, let's see what the world thinks about does a tangible, detectable, living devil exist. Well, the world certainly thinks so. Has anyone here had to suffer through reading this book? A few hands raising again? Yeah, a couple of you have. Okay, my condolences. This is a novel that was written around 1600 A.D. and entitled Dr. Faustus by a fellow by the name of Christopher Marlowe. And Dr. Faustus, as this is in this novel, is a disillusioned doctor. He's tired of the way things are going. He's upset. He doesn't like the direction his life is going. And he tries to make a deal with the devil to change his direction of life. Again, written around 1600 A.D. This is a copy of the introduction sheet and for that book. But what's interesting about it is that during the first 1,000 years after Christ, it says there were a lot of stories, a number of stories of this kind, talking about someone trying to make a deal with the devil to get an advantage of some kind, and paying a price that goes with that. And it talks about during Justinian, fellow by the name of Theophilus, and goes on. I've highlighted in red down at the bottom, and again, this is verbatim off that intro sheet from it, that this story, Dr. Faustus, this legend, is representative of a lot of stories in that era, because there was a lot of interest in that theme during the Middle Ages. During the Middle Ages. So from, say, maybe 200 to 1100-ish, debatable, but sometime in that time frame, there's a lot of interest, a lot of popular support, if we could say, for this theme, this idea that a devil, make a deal, get an advantage for it. So from around 200 through at least 1600, a lot of folks in the world, European world, North American world, did believe in the existence of a tangible devil, one that you could make a deal with, negotiate. How about a little more current? Well, this is from surveys that were conducted in 1991 and 1993. One of the questions that was asked on the survey was, I definitely believe in the devil. Yes or no? I definitely, the word definitely was in the question. But look how they answered. Surprisingly, the United States is at the top of the list in believing in the existence of a devil. I definitely believe in the devil. Almost 50% of the people, 91, 93, Canada's not listed, I would assume it's the same, but almost half the people surveyed on this thing agree with the statement, I believe, definitely believe in the devil. And of course the list goes on down through, surprisingly to me, Israel at 12.5%. That's one out of eight at the time of this survey. 12 years ago? That one out of eight Israelis believe in a devil. West Germany somehow the lowest at nine. So from, let's say, 200 through 1991, the most current information that I could find is 2001. The Barna Research Group polled Christian denominations and asked them the same kind of questions. Look at the list. Above average belief in the existence of Satan. Surprisingly, 60% of the Mormons, Latter-day Saints, believe in the devil. Top of the list. Third on that list is Christian, non-denominational, mostly fundamentalists. We'd probably be categorized toward the fundamentalist concept, but they're at 48%, 50%, almost one out of two of those Christians that were polled here. Seventh-day Adventist, one-third of those, 37%. We'll talk about those in just a minute. If you go on down the list, below average, of course, going from 22 down to 17. That Roman Catholics at 17 is interesting to me because of all the religious structures, to me, you'd think Roman Catholics with their setup and structure would be a lot higher than 17%. And we'll look at that in a minute because it almost makes you suspect that data. Because in 1996, Associated Press release in regards to the Catholic Church, and I can't read it, but I've highlighted with the red arrow. This is from Cardinal George somebody or other, who says, look, the existence of the devil is not an opinion, something to take or leave as you wish, says this cardinal. I guess the cardinals have all been in the news recently. Anyone, notice what he says, anybody who says that the devil does not exist, would not have the fullness of the Catholic Church. In other words, official party line with the Catholic Church is, you want to be a Catholic, you believe in the devil. Whether you like it or not, you're going to believe in the devil. Although, when polled away from the cardinal, 17% seemed to come up with that. We had talked about they Adventist. If you look at the bottom of that sheet, this is from an official Seventh-day Adventist publication published in 1957. It's they answering questions on their doctrine. And in light blue, as to Satan, or the devil, we, Seventh-day Adventists, hold the uniform teaching. We're hand-in-hand on this. We all agree with this statement that concerning the teaching of the Word, in other words, from the Bible, from the Scriptures, that he, the devil, is definitely a personal being. Definitely a personal being. The supreme adversary of God and man. We're not going to read through, but look at the phrases that I've highlighted in red. This is how they describe and pick and choose what they want out of the verses. He was once an angel of light. He was named Lucifer. He fell from his high estate. He drew down a host of angels. Prince of the devils now. He is the embodiment of created perfection. He led a host of angels in rebellion against God and Christ, and he is now the leader of the demons. Now, I'm bringing this one up because over the years, believe it or not, sadly, I've had conversations with Christadelphian brothers, usually my elders at the time, I'm getting up there with them now, but who have told me, you know, we're not that far off from some of the beliefs that the Seventh-day Adventists have. I'm sorry, I don't buy that. I totally disagree with that, but I've had it told to me more than one occasion. But this is from their official publication. All right. Okay, so look. We've polled society. Nobody's gotten a millionaire, so we've missed that. But we've polled for the opinion of society. But now my question for you, we've seen that from 200 AD-ish up until 2001, a lot of folks, at least in North America, but we saw the international listing winding up through Israel and onward, that a lot of folks believe in the existence of a devil. So my question for you now is, does that prove that the devil exists? What does prove mean? Prove means to eliminate all doubt concerning veracity. All doubt has to go. Prove, it's beyond the shadow of a doubt. So does all this nonsense that we've looked at prove that the devil exists? Well, of course it does not. What it does tell us, though, is that there's a lot of people in a lot of denominations over a lot of years that buy the concept of a devil. A lot of people over a lot of time, maybe not the majority of people, but a lot of that polling was within so-called Christian ranks. But, you know, folks aren't always right. Folks aren't always right in what they believe and what they teach, and in fact, in what the majority teaches or believes or holds. Has anybody here ever heard of the Flat Earth Society? More hands. Good. Anybody know anybody that belongs to the Flat Earth Society? No. Okay. The Flat Earth Society still exists. You can find it. It's of course on the internet. Everything's on the internet, but you can find it. The majority isn't always right. You know, the Flat Earth Society, for those of you that don't know what it is, literally said, taught, believed, held to be true that the Earth was a flat, you know, disc or square or rectangle, something. A flat, not a sphere. If you got too close to the edge, like the ship, you fall over. Christopher Columbus didn't buy that theory. Some of his crew did, but he didn't. But this was the official dogma back in that era in the 1400s, just after the era of the Middle Ages, I guess kind of the start of some of the Dark Ages, but that's what they believed. You got too close to the edge, you're going to fall off. That was scientific teaching, that was religious teaching, but the majority isn't always right. In fact, I knew Christadelphians three generations ago that believed in the flat earth, one of whom belonged to the society. Christadelphians, three generations ago. For those of you that are real young, that seems like a long time, but it's not. Three generations ago, Christadelphians believed in. The point is, the majority is not always right. And in fact, the majority is quite often wrong. Okay. The devil is viewed by popular religion and society at large, really, as a more or less equal, but not quite, an opposite kind of a god. If there's any truth to that assumption, that he is a more or less equal, but not quite, but an opposite kind of a god, if there's any truth to that, then there are some really serious logical problems. God created man. He gave him five senses to detect his environment. Up there on the overhead. He gave us an eye in which we can see the visible portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. The spectrum is huge and our eye can detect a little sliver of it. But it's amazing what the eye can do. It can detect frequency. It's translated as color. We can detect intensity to a magnificent range of strengths. And with the two eyes and stereoscopic, we can range. We can figure out how far things are based on just that one sensory input organ. We've got hearing, our ears. We can detect changing sound vibrations, sound pressures, pressure waves through air. With two ears, we can detect not only location, but we're allowed to detect frequency, high, low, strengths, is it strong or is it weak? And again, we can locate a point of origin to a degree. We've got a tongue that allows us to taste. We can detect with our tongue a wide range of sensory input. Sweet, sour, bitter, not bitter. Strong sensations, weak sensations. It's an amazing organ that we've got for sensory input. Touch. Touch is amazing as well. Our whole skin, really, is a sensory organ. With touch, we can detect pressure, friction, temperature, lubricity, near presence. It's amazing what input we can get just off of skin, touch. And finally, the last thing is, we have a nose that can detect nice smells, bad smells, strong smells, weak smells. Some of us have big noses, some of us have little noses, but it all works. The first two organs, sight and hearing, seem to be emphasized in the scriptures. We'll look at that in a minute. Those are the two input paths that give us not only the most information, but the highest data rate that those two organs can transfer the most information to us in the smallest amount of time. But we've got these five senses to detect our environment. And we've got a brain to process that. Five sensory inputs and the brain to process it. The brain to reason, to evaluate. There's that word again. And according to theology, according to popular theology, God created the devil, supposedly. The issue is that God also created the humans. The same people that say that God created the devil agree that God created the humans and made it so that a man can detect some of God's characteristics by discerning the things that he has created around him. But he can use his mind that we've been given to discern some little bits about what God's will is. You know, Paul in Romans says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." Our brain gives us the ability to take these five senses, and that's all we've got, is five senses. We call someone handicapped when one of those senses is gone, or two are gone, or three are gone. And God has given us these senses to evaluate our environment, usually our near environment. The eye and the ear can detect a little bit further in distance. And we can understand some of the things by reasoning, by evaluating. But we need to understand the importance that God puts in using these senses that he has made. Not going to read the verses, but look in Psalm 33 at verse 18, talks about the eye of the Lord being open to those that fear him. In Matthew 6, jumping into the New Testament, If thine eye be single, in other words, focused, concentrated, of one mind, the whole body shall be full of light. Same words, Old Testament to New Testament. Psalm 17 picks up the verse, picks up the word of an ear. Incline thine ear unto me, the ear of God. Isaiah 59, his ear, the Lord's ear, is also not heavy that it cannot hear. And to make sure that there's no doubt as to how they're used, Proverbs, there's several other verses that pick it up too, talks about both an ear and an eye, those first two sensory organs, the highest data rate, the ones that give us the most information that we can tell the most about, says the Lord has made even both of them. The point is that God went so far as to send His Son. He that hath seen me hath seen the Father, from John 14. This was visible evidence of not only the Son that walked among Jewry at the time, but it was also proof of the existence of God Himself. And it was discernible only by the five senses, as the people looked at and touched and saw and heard the Messiah teaching. The five senses detect, the brain processes, evaluates, and we're able to understand some of the characteristics about God. The problem is, none of this applies to a devil or Satan. Can't be detected by the five senses. The mind is left blank. Really, everything else that God created, and in theory God created the devil, everything else can be detected by these five senses, the five senses that we've been given. How come then, if God created a devil, if God created a devil, how come we can't detect it? We've only been given five ways to detect anything. Once those five senses are cut off, the mind's blank. The five senses can't find that. All right? We can't also we cannot detect any offspring, any son of the devil to vouch for the devil, or to express its mind, or to prove its existence. It has to be a two-way street. If we can't use our senses to find something that God has supposedly created, that supposedly the devil, then there's no way for this devil to use those same senses to affect our judgment. It just can't work. Our senses are the only way we have of getting information. So I submit to you as a jury that from this point alone, there's more than a reasonable or justifiable doubt that a devil even exists. Second point, free will versus a controlled mind. God created man, gave him the ability to obey or to disobey, to please or to displease, to sin or to not sin, to honor or to dishonor. That's the definition of free will. The ability to choose. And we make those choices every minute of every day. We're not programmed to obey. We're not programmed to please or to honor or to not sin. And we're not forced to either. We make that choice every minute of our lives. You know, in the Garden of Eden, it's all about choice and free will. Starting all the way back in Genesis, they had the choice to obey or to not obey, to please or to displease, to honor or to dishonor, but they had the choice. And to make sure that everybody understood that, when the law was repeated in Deuteronomy, look what Moses says. He says, look, I have set before you this day a choice, options, life and good, death and evil. And then in verse 16, he talks about what's going to happen if the life and the good are chosen. In verse 17 and 18, he talks about what's going to happen if the other side is chosen, death and evil. What are the consequences of both? And finally, look at verse 19. We're talking about free will, the ability to have choices. Moses says, I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose. Choose free will. choose life. He wants that to be chosen, but there's an option, a choice that the people had to make. If the devil could make somebody, force somebody to do a deed, in other words, no free will, then the devil has the ability to reconstruct the mind of the creature into something that the Creator did not design. That doesn't make any sense. In other words, the devil is able to do something that the Father could not, the Creator did not, could not do. Could the Creator make a creature more powerful than himself? That doesn't make any sense either. And we're not talking about the circular questions about can God do anything? Is He, you know, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent? Yes, we understand those. But we're not talking about the instance where people ask the foolish question, could God make a rock so heavy that He couldn't lift it? That's not what we're talking about. The question is, can God create an obedient, pre-programmed to obey human race by design? And the answer is, yes, He could have. He could have created mankind that didn't have the choice to obey, disobey, honor, dishonor, please, displease. He could have taken that choice away. And the people would just be programmed robots, forced to obey, programmed to obey with no option. But He didn't. The question is, can He then create a human race that will always, always, always be obedient and yet allow that person to make its own choices? And the answer is, He can't do that. He can't do that. It has to choose to be voluntarily obedient of its own volition. God cannot create it to be voluntarily obedient. Again, I submit to you from this perspective, reasonable doubt. Third perspective. If this statement of defense is valid, the devil made me do it. If that's valid, again, kind of a blunt statement, but what'd the devil get out of it? What's his pay? What's his reward? What's his take? What'd he get out of it? Well, an equally valid or good answer is also from this novel, this book, Dr. Faustus. And again, Faustus, kind of a guy that's upset with life and again tries to make this deal with the devil. Mephistopheles, which I've shortened as M-E-P-H, Mephistopheles is supposed to be the devil's agent, his gopher, do all the dirty work for him. So Faustus asks the question of Mephistopheles and says, look, what good is my soul going to do your lord, the devil? Talking to Mephistopheles. So Mephistopheles answers with three words, enlarge his kingdom. That answer doesn't seem to satisfy Faustus, Dr. Faustus, because he comes back, well, is that the reason why he tempts us like he does? Mephistopheles answers in Latin, but it's translated, to the unhappy, it is a comfort to have had companions in misfortune. In other words, it's just to get more. That was the only answer from, let's call it, 200 through 1600. That was the reason for these alleged temptations by an alleged devil in that sense. It was just to get more. That was the purpose. That was the gain. That was the reward. And mankind still has not learned that more isn't always better. In fact, usually more is just more. But remember, the devil and God are supposed to be kind of equals, but opposites. But God has a very real and different purpose. His desire is to be honored by the voluntary obedience of His creation, something that He can't make or force. Rewind your timeline back and consider the time of slavery here in the U.S., a slave master overseeing a group of slaves. You know, the slave didn't really have too much of a... obeyed, he wasn't punished. If he disobeyed, he was punished, he was tortured, he was killed, whatever. But what glory or honor or respect or reward was there for his master in that kind of forced obedience? He got what he wanted. The slave did the work or was killed. But what reward or benefit back to the slave master? The only conclusion that can be reached here from this perspective is that there's nothing at all to be gained by a devil that can force somebody to do something. And it's only for the purpose of getting more recruits. There's no glory. There's no honor. There's no pride. There's nothing. Again, third point, reasonable doubt. Finally, our last point that we're looking at this afternoon is to say that the devil made me do it as a statement of defense is an attempt to assign and transfer the blame for an action, something usually bad. This statement of defense tries to remove the conscious motivation for a person's actions to an outside entity, an outside agency. If this were an acceptable defense, then the blame or the wrongdoing or the transgression or the sin would never belong to anybody, any person, but it would always belong to the devil if one were to exist. The Apostle Paul knew exactly that. We read about his wrestling of the problem in Romans 7 just a few minutes ago and his acknowledgement that his inclination to sin was his problem. It was his fault. It was his nature. It was not due to a devil. You know, it's kind of like the argument of a gun and a person. What caused the injury when the person, the victim, was shot? Was it the person pulled the trigger? Or was it the finger that actually pulled the trigger? Or was it the hammer that the trigger released? Or was it the primer in the shell? Or was it the projectile? What was it that actually caused the injury, the death, the damage to the victim? You know, in our vernacular, that's called passing the buck. And it's been tried unsuccessfully, really, since the Garden of Eden. And there's been problems with it all the way along. And certainly not making light of what else is contained in Genesis 3. But the questions are asked in verse 11. The Lord asks, "Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou should not eat?" And verse 12, the man answers in the affirmative. He says, "The woman that you gave me, she gave me of the tree, and yes, I did eat." And in verse 13, the next question comes from the Lord to the woman. "What have you done?" And the woman says, "Well, the serpent beguiled me, and yes, I did eat." It doesn't work. That as a simple defense, it doesn't work. Only a few verses later, the response comes back off of that. "To the woman, thy desire shall be to thy husband, he shall rule over thee." In verse 17, "Cursed is the ground," speaking to Adam, "for thy sake, in sorrow shalt thou eat of it," all the days of thy life. "Thorns and thistles." And finally in verse 19, "You will return to the ground, for you were taken out of it, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return." This line of defense, attempting to blame somebody, something, or somebody else for your own irresponsible actions, has always been condemned by God. To attempt it again by reference to some alleged overpowering influence of evil and disobedience, it only serves to point out the frailty of what human nature is actually all about. And it literally flies in the face of God's creative nature. The devil's existence is therefore actually disproven by this line of reasoning, because the sinner can never be responsible. The sinner, the person, the sinner is taken out of the equation, no longer even involved in the episode. So, okay, look, to conclude what we've said, there are four logical inconsistencies with this idea of the devil made me do it. Firstly, it requires as a precondition that you accept the existence of a devil before the argument can even be valid. It's called circular reasoning, and it's invalid. Secondly, to accept it as a statement of defense, it eliminates free will and it requires forced obedience. We weren't made that way. Thirdly, it removes any and all benefit for a devil if one were to exist. In other words, why would he do it? And fourthly, it transfers all responsibility away from the person, and it disproves the concept of the existence of a devil because the sinner is out of that part of the equation. Can't be responsible. As a statement of defense, the devil made me do it. It just doesn't work. All it does is reiterate the excuse, the serpent beguiled me and made me do it. And all of this is just a rephrase of that original lie, thou shalt not surely die. But the problem is, in Genesis 5:5, it records that all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he did die. He did die. It was a lie. Thou shalt not surely die, but he did die. And there's no doubt from everyone's experience and from the historical record that, in fact, he did die. Death has been with us daily for 6,000 years, and it's going to be with us until the day that the Lord Jesus comes back to this earth in visible proof that the statement, the devil made me do it, is just nothing more than a continuation of the lie that man's carried with him, really, since the Garden of Eden. Man continues to want to believe in that lie, though, thou shalt not surely die. And to use this statement that the devil made me do it is just another vain attempt to carry on that tradition. So look, if you were an actual jury, you could not reach any other conclusion than to agree that to stake your eternal life on the statement, the devil made me do it, is unjustified, it's unsupportable, and it's foolish. Thank you.